DSE, as the thesis according to which extension is a non-material property belonging both to corporeal substances and to incorporeal ones. A standard formulation of this thesis is given by Moore on December 11, 1648, in his first letter to Descartes. I quote, "Res enim extensa Deo videtur esse, atque angelus, imo vero, res quelibet per se subsistens, ita ut, e isdem finibus claudi videatur extensio, atque essentia rerum absoluta, quetamen variari potest, pro essentiarum ipsarum varietate." Henry Moore holds this thesis all his life long, with the only exception of his first poems, where he seems to identify extension with matter. Indeed, since the time of the correspondence with Descartes, up to the scholia of the Opera Omnia of 1789-81, through his three most important philosophical works, The Immortality of the Soul, The Divine Dialogues, and The Inquiridium Metaphysicum, this thesis is constantly defended by Moore. Moreover, the doctrine of spiritual extension has a prominent importance in Moore's thought. In the correspondence with Descartes, it lies under all the questions debated there, from the problem of the definition of matter up to the problem of the relativity of the movement, through the questions of the vacuum, the atoms, and the infinity of the world, on which I will get back. This thesis is also at the heart of the most mature formulation of metaphysics, the Inquiridium Metaphysicum, and in particular of chapters 27 and 28, which will be afterwards published separately under the title The Easy, True and Genuine Notion and Explication of the Nature of a Spirit, where Moore will expressly address the question of the definition of the essence of spiritual substances. The importance of this thesis, as Moore taught, explains why scholars have always devoted so much attention to the question of the source of this theory. I will sketch here some general information about the status questionis. At the risk of simplifying, I think that the principal hypothesis can be grouped into three principal sets. 1. A large number of interpreters claim that the sources of this theory should be found in the Neoplatonic doctrine about space. This is an interpretation proposed in 1950 by Émile Barrayer and then accepted, among the others, by Arrigo Pacchi, Serge Hutten, and more recently by Alexander Jacob. According to the picture sketched by Breyer, and proposed again by Hutten, at the core of the discussion between Descartes and Moore, there will be the eternal debate between the Aristotelism and the Platonism. Other scholars, and this is the second solution, insisted on the influence of the Kabbalah on this theory. In his famous history of theories of space, Max Jammer claimed that the Newtonian notion of space, on which modern physics is grounded, would be the result of two factors. On the one side, the progressive dissolution of Aristotelic natural philosophy's paradigm, and, on the other side, the influence of theological and philosophical theories of space as an attribute of God. So, according to Jammer, Moore would have reprised this theory from the Kabbalah, though interpreting it in a pantheistic sense, which is extraneous to the genuine Jewish tradition. According to Jammer, Moore was, and I quote, "one of the greatest rabbinical students of his time." However, other interpreters found this interpretation questionable. According to Alexander Coiré, Moore's many references to the Kabbalah tradition should be read more as a quote, "typical case of retroprojection into the past of modern conceptions in order to back them up by sacred or venerable authorities." But the stronger criticism against the thesis of the influence of Kabbalah came from Aaron Lichtenstein, who argued against Yammer that Moore's knowledge of the Kabbalah was fragmentary and mostly second and third hand. Lichtenstein's criticism was accepted by Arrigo Pacchi, through the thesis of the influence of the Kabbalah has been proposed again by Brian Copenhauer, through correcting many of Yammer's conclusions. I come now to interpretation 3. What interpretations 1 and 2 have in common, in spite of their differences, is the assumption that the sources of Moore's theory should be found outside the scholastic tradition. Such an interpretation was broken by Edward Grant's book Much Ado Above Nothing, where Moore's theory is connected to contemporary scholastic debate on the presence of God within imaginary spaces. Grant's book had the merit to turn from the too much general alternative Platonist Kabbalah and to focus on a background which is quite closer both from a chronological and geographical point of view. A relevant example of this new direction of the research is Emanuela Scribano's attempt of relating Moore's theory to contemporary Arminians and Socinians' debate on divine immensity. The disagreement among the interpretation I reported above seems to suggest that a structural difficulty here arises, especially if we consider that what should be established in speaking about sources of a theory is a real influence and not a bare historical antecedent. However, all the interpretations that are related above, in spite of their differences, seem to share a common methodological approach. In looking for the sources of Moore's theory, they don't take into account the possibility of a diachronic development of the theory. Now, such an approach seems to me to be quite inadequate in the case of Moore, whose philosophical and theological theories evolve over the years in many and different respects, as sometimes Moore himself points out to his readers. And this is also the case of the theory of spiritual extension, as some recent studies have shown in detail, and as I will stress later. I can mention here Jasper Reed's article on Journal of the History of Philosophy, which later became part of a chapter of his book, for example, which is a very important study. In the light of this, I think that a more adequate approach would be to consider Moore's theory in a chronologically definite step into the evolution of Moore's thought. That is the goal that I will pursue in this article, where I will limit the investigation of the sources to Moore's correspondence with Descartes in 48-49. The theory is introduced by Moore in his first letter to Descartes of December 1148, at the very beginning of his first objection, which is addressed against Descartes' definition of extension by matter. Descartes' definition, according to Moore, is not correct because extension doesn't belong to matter only, but to incorporeal substances too. According to Moore, a material substance is a tangible or impenetrable one, in contrast with the incorporeal substance, which, though being extended to, is penetrable by itself. In his reply of February 5, Descartes will answer that it is impossible to attribute a true extension, vera extensio, to spiritual substances. Indeed, they can be said extended only per analogiam, by analogy, as they act on what is extended without being really extended in themselves. Moore will never concede this point to Descartes. In the second letter of March 5, Moore will reply that it is true that what Descartes calls a true extension, vera extensio, includes tangibility and impenetrability, and as a consequence cannot be found neither in God, neither in angels, and in the human souls. Nevertheless, there is another extension belonging to spiritual substances that, though not so well known and in use in the school, is likewise true. In angels and human soul, this extension has limits and shape, though variable depending on the will. The souls and the angels can in this way to contract and to expand themselves in certain limits while the same substance remains. I quote, per veram extensionem intelligis quam tangibilitas et impenetrabilitas comitatur. Anc ipse etiam nego in Deo, nudis vehemente vel angelo reperiri. Interea tamen assero aliam esse extensionem eque veram, quamvis non eque vulgarem scolisque tritam, quae in angelis menteque humana ut terminos it et figuram abet, sed pro imperio angeli mentisque variabilem. Mentesque sive animas nostra atque angelos e adem prorsus manente substantia contraere se posse et certos denuo ad limites se expandere. But how to think an incorporeal being as extended without attributing to it divisibility, has Descartes objected. More replied by two arguments. The first one is that extension belongs to the being such as being. And the second argument is that the spirit exists all in all and all in each part. This is the second reply is the doctrine that more afterwards we'll call Olemmerismus, and that he defended in his poems too. However, some years later, in his Immortality of the Soul of 59, and especially in his Enchiridium Metaphysicum in 71, More will reject it, keeping only the first of the two arguments that he had used in the correspondence to refute the alleged convertibility between extension and divisibility. And the Prefatio Generalissima to the Opera Omnia of 79 will reveal that the criticism addressed against Olemmerism in the Immortality and the Enchiridium was in fact a self-criticism. Now, this is a relevant point, according to me, not only for the reconstruction of the evolution of Moore's thought, but also for the precise identification of the sources of his theory in the form that Moore presents it in the correspondence with Descartes, as I will try to show in what follows. During the development of the first difficulty posed by Moore to Descartes, there is no reference to any sources. What it seems to me undeniable, in spite of Grant's attempt to connect Moore's theory to the scholastic debate on the imaginary space, is that Moore opposes his conception of extension to the one proposed by scholastics. I quote, this is a passage from the quotation I made before, interea tamen assero aliam esse extensionem eque veram, quamvis non eque vulgarem scolisque tritam. Indeed, it is clear that Moore relates his conception of extension to the Platonic tradition. And I quote, unde sane felicius mihi videtur cum platonicis suis Virgilius philosophari quam Cartesius ipse, cum ex illorum sententia sic cecinerit, totanque infusa per artus, mens agitat molem et magno se corpore miscet, which is a very, very famous quotation at that time. Besides this generic allusion, however, in the whole discussion between Moore and Descartes concerning the definition of matter, there is no other suggestion which might in some way reveal the sources of Moore's theory. The things are different, however, if we consider a text of the second letter of Moore, the letter of March 5, concerning the development of the fourth difficulty posed by Moore to Descartes in his first letter, that is, the infinity of the world. Moore that questioned the distinction, elaborated by Descartes in the Principia Philosophiae, between infinite and indefinite. According to Moore, the Cartesian notion of an indefinite extension is completely unintelligible. If something is it in itself simpliciter, that is, infinite, there are no reasons to call it indefinite. On the contrary, if this thing is infinite, only compared to us, tantum quod nos, it will actually, revera, be finite, as the human mind is not in the measure of the things or of the truth. However, Moore doesn't limit itself to reject Descartes' notion of an indefinite world, but formulates some arguments aiming to prove that the world is in fact infinite. His first argument, that he had already proposed in 46 in his Democritus Platonicans, is that the infinity of the world has to be admitted once that the infinite extension of God has been stated, in the light of the same principles of Cartesian philosophy, and particularly from the thesis that the matter tends to go away in a straight line from the centers of vortices. As a matter of fact, without admitting an infinite world, the matter will be dispersed in the vacuum, filled up only by the divine extension. Notice that Moore here doesn't state the infinity of the world. He only insists on the fact that the thesis of a finite world that he had formally defended in 42, Notice that Moore does not state here the infinity of the world. He just insists on the fact that he inclines to think that the world is infinite. And this is in line with Democritus Platonicans, where, though rejecting the thesis of a finite world that he had formerly defended in 42, Moore presented the infinity of world not as a truth, but nothing more than as an hypothesis worth of discussion. Descartes, however, replies to Moore that the distinction between infinite and indefinite has to be maintained because of the impossibility of establishing if the world considered in itself, simpliciter, is finite or infinite. Moreover, according to Descartes, the extension of matter, of an indefinite matter, will prevent anyone imagining a place outside it into which the particles or the vortices could escape, insofar as wherever such a place may be conceived, there is some matter. In his second letter, Moore claims that it is necessary that the world is in itself finite or infinite, though for human mind it's difficult to establish this point. In addition, he proposes again the argument he had advanced in his first letter, the fact that the vortexes don't disperse themselves in space seems to indicate that the world is really infinite. However, Moore weakened a little the thesis of his first letter, in his second letter, in claiming that, although it is true that the world is in itself finite or infinite, he is not able to grasp fully the infinity of whatsoever thing. I quote, ipse tamen interea libere profiteor quam vis aud acter possima sentire huic axiomati mundus finitus est aut non finitus vel quod idem est infinitus me tamen non posse plene animo complecti rei cuius vis infinitudinem. In order to justify this claim, Moore adds, and I quote again, sed illud imaginationi mee hic accidere, quod Iulius scaligere alicubi scribit de dilatazione et contraczione angelorum. Non posse silicet se in infinitum extendere, nec in puncti ude noteta quam gustare. Moore refers here to the Italian philosopher Giulio Bordone, and medicine Giulio Bordone, better known as Giulio Cesare Scaligero o della Scala. It's certain that Moore read Scaliger, as Moore himself declares in the brief intellectual autobiography sketched in the Prefazio Generalissima to the Opera Omnia, where Scaliger is mentioned together with Aristotle and Cardano. I quote, sic igitur persuasus et ius fasque eratus esse, totum me in philosophiae studium ingurgitu, miram mihi pollicitus ex isto instituto felicitatem Aristotelem, igitur, Cardanum, Iulium Scaligerum, aliosque celeberrimi nominis philosophos diligenter evolvi. What's worth noting, however, in the passage I quoted above from the letter of March 5 to Descartes is that more reference to Scaligero is to a very precise thesis. Angels cannot extend themselves in infinitum, neither contract themselves in a point. The problem is that Moore doesn't indicate the text from where he takes Scaligero's statement, simply given a general information, alicubi. In order to identify this text, I've analyzed the Exotericarum Exercitationum Liber Quintus Decimus De Subtilitate ad Hieronymum Cardanum, which is certainly the most important and the most popular of Scaligero's works. To have an idea of this, it is sufficient to think that there are at least 11 editions between 1576, date of the first Parisian edition, and 1665. And also, it is certain that Moore knew this work because he often quotes them in his works. I discovered that the statement Moore attributes to Scaligero is a quite literal quotation of the Exercitatio 359, and precisely from a passage of the sixth article, Quomodo sunt indivisibiles et deorum diffusione atque contractione. A textual comparison shows that Moore's reference to Scaligero in the letter of March 5, 49 constitutes a true quotation of Scaligero's article. I quote, in the text that I sent to you by mail, I put in parallel, in a synoptic way, the two passages, but I quote again. Sed illud immaginazioni mei cacidere quod Iulius Scaligere alicubi scribite de dilatazione e contrazione angelorum. Non posse silicet se in infinitum extendere, nec in punti ude note taco angustare. This was Moore and Scaligero. Non enim in infinitum se se promoverit, neque ad punti ude noteta se se contraxerit. However, in order to fully appreciate this point, it seems to be necessary to place into the whole context of Scaligero's article. In fact, this Exercitatio 359, far from containing only the textual sources of more references, develops an elaborated doctrine of the spiritual extension that Moore reproduces in many aspects in his correspondence with Descartes. And this is what I plan to show in the following pages through a more detailed analysis of Scaligero's text. The passage of Scaligero quoted by Moore constitutes, in the Exercitatio, an intermediate step of a broader discussion which concerns, according to the title itself, the intelligences, the angels and the mind. The title is, in fact, De Intelligentis Angeli Mentes. The point of departure of Scaligero's analysis is the Article 2, De Essentia Angelorum, where a basic difference between God and intelligence is established. As a matter of fact, only God is a pure actus, a cause which has no cause, and a being without being, pure essence, mera essentia. On the contrary, though not constituted by shape and matter, intelligences are actus commingled with potency. The act is their essence, and the potency is their being. The corollary that Scaligero draws from these premises is outlined in the third article, De Intelligentiarum Finita Natura. Insofar as they are different from the first being, intelligences are limited in four senses: in power, because they depend on the first intelligence; in essence, because infinity belongs to God only; in number, because they are not infinite in number; in quantity, because the quantity cannot exceed the substance. A question arises, however, concerning the quantity of the intelligences, and Scaligero claim, ergo quante sunt intelligentiae? Scaligero's answer is affirmative. Intelligences are quante, insofar as they are provided with an intelligible quantity. Quante quidem aut quantitate predicamentali, sed quantitate intelligibili. The proof As it is stated in the fourth article, De figura intelligentiarum, is that the intelligences are measurable and circumscribed in limits they are not able to overcross. It is therefore necessary that a shape belongs to them. I quote. Intelligentia fines habet, quos ultra et praeter non potest designari. Necesse sit, aliqua figura predita sit. I will designate this text as two. As a consequence of what is there established, Scaliger claims in the following article, De ubi intelligentiarum, that a place should be attributed to the intelligences, though not in the same way that place belongs to bodies. However, the fact that shape and place belong to intelligences pose the problem of their divisibility. Indeed, if intelligences are provided with quantitative determinations, shouldn't they be divisible too? This is precisely the question Scaliger deals with in Article 6, where the text quoted by Moore at the beginning in his correspondence with Descartes is contained. I mean the text where Moore quotes Scaliger. The solution of this question commits Scaliger to a number of explanations about the thesis of the local presence. Scaliger begins to claim that two angels can be in the same place. Duo angeli, I quote, esse potuerunt in eodem ubi. And this poses the question of clarifying the precise modalities in which angels are in the place. According to Scaliger, angels contract and expand themselves in a place, keeping a certain and finite magnitude. Contrai vero et diffundi angelos a certa sibi magnitudine, sed certa finitaque verum est. In this text, that I will designate as 3, the thesis of the presence of finite intelligences in the place is integrated with a doctrine of contraction and expansion, which is in order to explain the way in which intelligences occupy space. Accordingly, if we put together the different points established by Scaliger in his Exercitatio, it emerges that 2 theses are here established. First, the angels and the intelligences are provided with certain limits and with a shape. And this is the text that I called before, text number 2. And second thesis, the movement of the angels and the intelligences is by expansion and contraction within a certain and finite magnitude. And this is the text number 3. Now, these 2 theses are both claimed by Moore in his correspondence with Descartes. Moreover, it is possible to establish a textual comparison suggesting the syntactic and the lexical analogy between Moore's formulation and Scaliger's text. I quote, Moore to Descartes, 5 March 49, In angelis menteque humana ut terminos ita et figuram habet. Terminos et figuram. Scaliger, intelligentia fines habet, quos ultra ac praeter non potest designari, necesse sit, aliqua figura predita sit. Again, Moore to Descartes, of the same letters, mentesque sive animas nostras atque angelos eadem prorsus manente substantia contraere se posse et certos denuo ad limites se expandere. Contraere, certos, limites expandere. Contrai vero et diffundi, angelos a certa sibi magnitudine, sed certa finitaque verum est, Scaliger. It should be added here that the text that I called above one, that is the text where Moore quotes Scaliger, follows immediately in the Exercitatio, the text number 3, and it is precisely introduced by Scaliger in order to explain it. Indeed, after stating that angels and intelligences occupy the place by expansion and contraction within a certain certa magnitude, Scaliger tries to give an explanation of what this certa magnitudo is. And he claims, certa est, non enim in infinitum sese promoverit, neque ad puncti udenoteta sese contraxerit. So, what we have here are all the elements of a true doctrine of the extension of spiritual substances. And this becomes explicit in the article 12, where Scaligero addresses the question of how it is possible to claim both that two angels are subjected to movement and that they are not divisible. Indeed, if angels are indivisible, how is it possible to attribute to them the movement, if whatever is in movement seems to entail a division? Scaligero's answer is that the intelligences are not subjected to a corporeal movement, insofar as they are provided with that kind of movement properly belonging to extended corporeal things. I quote, "Non movetur motu corporis, sed motu rei incorpore extense mutando ubi." To sum up, what we find in Scaligero is not only a theory of the extension of spiritual substances, but the very syntagm res incorporea in extensa. And this is not all yet. Indeed, there is another proof showing that Scaligero exercitatio constitutes the source of Morse theory in the precise formulation that we find in 48-49. In order to substantiate this point, I need one moment to come back to Morse correspondence with Descartes, and in particular, to his reply against the objection that Morse theory involves the divisibility of the substances to which extension pertains. Indeed, this is the same objection faced by Scaligero in the Article 6 quoted by Moore. Scaligero's answer was that angels, in spite of being extended, are not indivisible for two reasons. First, because there is not any contrary principle that they could suffer from. And second, because their essence exists wholly in each part without matter. I quote, "Indivisibiles autem dicuntur, quia non habent contrarium a quo patiantur. Et sane, tota essentia in quaecunque parte est sine materia." That spiritual substances exist wholly in each part is exactly the olemeristic doctrine that Moore will defend in his correspondence with Descartes, as I noted before, and precisely in answering against the same objection faced by Scaligero, that is, that extension implies divisibility. However, in his Enchiridion Metaphysicum, Moore, though still proposing the theory of the extension of spiritual substances, will reject olemerism. And the version of his theory that he will present in 71 is, accordingly, quite different of the one defended in 48. Spiritual substances are extended, but not existing wholly in each part. On the other side, the version of his theories proposed in the correspondence with Descartes follows Scaligero's one not only in claiming that spiritual substances are extended, but also in claiming that they exist wholly in each part. In stressing that Scaligero's exercitatio constitutes the source of Moore's doctrine, in the version of 48-49 formulation, however, I don't want to claim that the two positions are identical. In spite of the strong analogies, there is an aspect where Moore's theory, both in the version of 48-49 and in the version of 71, is different from Scaligero's account. Indeed, Scaligero rejected the thesis of a possible presence of God in the place, ubi. Indeed, he claims, place is a characteristic necessary to all the beings but God. I quote, "At ubi est circumstantia necessaria omnibus entibus praeter Deum. Est igitur ubietas affectus entis cuiusque necessarius praeter Deum." Now, what characterizes Moore's theory? Since the years of the correspondence with Descartes to the end of Moore's philosophical career is, on the contrary, the statement that extension belongs to all the beings with no exception, God included, that God is extended, is the very first point established by Moore in his first letter to Descartes. God's extension is deduced in this passage of the first passage of Moore's correspondence with Descartes from God's omnipresence, which is in turn deduced from God's action on matter. How could God to imprint movement to the matter, which he has done once, and still he does, as Descartes himself recognizes, if he didn't touch it, or he had not touched it once nearly closely? If God were not present everywhere, he could not occupy one by one the places of the universe. In fact, according to Moore, extension is a general property of being. In answering to Descartes' objection that the extension of substance would entail its divisibility, Moore stressed, as we have seen before, that extension shouldn't be attributed to corporal being, but to being as being. In the Enchiridion Metaphysicum, this thesis will develop in the statement that place constitutes a universal characteristic of being, like unum, verum, and bonum. On this point, therefore, Moore's theory cannot be explained in the light of Scaligero's theory of incorporeal extension. And it is interesting to notice also that in the Prefatio Generalissima, immediately after mentioning Scaligero, as we have seen, Moore adds, ubi profecto, and he refers to his Jovenel poems, tam etsi in quasdam subinde incidi satisque satis argue et aliquando solide dicta, pleraque tamen, aut tam falsa mihi videbantur, aut incerta, aut trivalia denique. Should be argued here that among the falsa, aut incerta, aut trivalia, there is also Scaligero's claim that God is not extended? This is nothing more than an hypothesis. And the question remains to know which are the sources of the Moore's thesis of the extension of God. On the other side, what we are authorized to conclude, I think, is that Moore's theory, in the form that it assumes in the correspondence with Descartes, results from the convergence of two elements. On one side, as regards the extension of intelligences and the angels, the theory is derived from Scaligero. And on the other side, as regards God's extension, the theory is presented by Moore as a necessary consequence of the essential and operational omnipresence of God. I mean, operational omnipresence is the omnipresence by power. Omnipresentia potentia, as he states. The question, in conclusion, is still unanswered concerning the sources of Moore's thesis of the extension of God. And in this sense, the identification in Scaligero of the source of Moore's theory seems to me to reopen, more than to close, the question which I tried to address in this short paper. Thank you.